Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to the programme.
And I'm Lizzie Burden. This is your daily guide to the corridors of power.
Oh, it must be pretty tricky right now, though. Kwasi Kwarteng saying sorry, sort of, for the mini budget. I think really that is the key takeaway in terms of the economy this morning, as we got those GDP figures that show just how bad things are, Lizzie.
Was he really saying sorry? Doesn't seem like it. And Jeremy Hunt's come out and said that it's really not appropriate to be blaming the big picture for the 44 days of Trussonomics. And let's not forget, if you look at that budget, what really upset the markets was that you had this massive untargeted energy bailout, you had all these unfunded tax cuts. They undermined the UK's economic institutions, not to mention the fact that it was politically unpalatable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bloomberg Intelligence talking about Britain's prospects worse in the coming quarters because you've got fiscal tightening, restrictive monetary policy, you've got a global slowdown in the background of a cost of living crisis. It's really hard to kind of be positive now, even though in 6 days' time, you've got the autumn statement. Recession looms if in the last 3 months of the year we have a contraction in GDP. The UK is now the group of seven economy that has yet to fully recover from the pandemic, the only one. So we're going to spend a bit of time unpacking winter is coming in the UK with our UK economy reporter, Phil Aldrich. Philip, thanks so much for being with us on radio. So look, we've had, let's start with the autumn statement briefings, loads and loads of briefings, it would seem, or at least speculation about what is going to be in this delayed budget come next week. What do you think is actually on the table?
Well, you've got to think about what his incentives are, and he's got to, you know, there is this recession and he's got to balance the books. So he's got to find a balance between supporting the economy and fiscal credibility, which in theory would point towards backloading as much of the hardship as he can. So there's been reports that there's this kind of stealth tax, stealth income tax through freezing the thresholds for an extra couple of years. That'll drag more people into higher rates and capture more of their income for tax purposes. So that seems very likely because that'll be towards the end of the forecast period. So we're assuming that he's going to have to balance the books within about 5 years. Or not balance the books, by what I mean is he's going to have to bring debt down as a share of GDP. That'll be his target, I think. And so he can, by extending the income tax thresholds for those extra couple of years, he'll get some more revenue. And then there's also talk about spending on the spending cut side. What you do is at the again, after this particular spending review period is over, you don't freeze the budgets of the departments, but you let them rise only in line with inflation or only just above inflation. So they can declare real-term increases, but that is lower than what is currently penciled into the budgets beyond the current spending round. So you save money in that and that way, but also, but again, it's later in the parliament, it's later in the forecast period, so towards the end of the 5 years coming, that you start to get that money, because you need the 50 billion in 2027, 2028. You don't need to get the 50 billion that, you know, tomorrow.
And of course, one of the ways that is being talked about potentially making a saving is delaying or cancelling infrastructure projects, because it's easier to not notice shovels not going in the ground than, say, other cuts. But given that infrastructure is such a crucial part of levelling up, and Rishi Sunak's made clear that he's really leaning on the 2019 manifesto and Boris Johnson's mandate, can they actually get away with that, especially in the Red Wall, where revving up was so important?
Well, the increase in capital spending by government, so investment spending by government, is quite significant, what the plans were under Boris Johnson. So you can reduce investment spending and still claim to be growing investment spending more than historic averages for the last 15, 20 years. So it's at a time, I mean, if you look back to the original austerity 1.0, that's exactly what got hit originally. And it was Labour who actually initially, under Alistair Darling, that brought in these capital spending cuts. It is an easy way to make savings, and it's almost certain that they're going to do that to a degree. But obviously, again, it's going to be about balancing, how much do you bring it down whilst also providing enough for some kind of investment spending. I mean, there are other things on the table. This, the energy windfall tax could be expanded. You've got there's talk about a dividend tax being increased to owner managers, who basically pay lower income tax than if they were paying themselves a wage. Their income in dividends will be captured, and there'll be foreign aid is also there's talks about 5 billion savings through foreign aid. There's a lot of sort of bit piecemeal things, as well as those big ones that I mentioned originally.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting. I wonder whether you guys read the Telegraph piece about, the pain for middle England, raiding pension funds is sort of particularly unpopular. I mean, it makes you wonder whether Sunak and Hunt have actually thought about electability as well as sort of being a kind of technocratic government. But maybe we'll come back to that, because I want to sandwich in a bit of sound, which was from this morning, which is Chancellor Jeremy Hunt responding actually to the GDP figures, because that all makes the pain enormous now. Have a listen.
If we are going to bring down debt over the medium term and give people confidence that we are paying our way as a country, then yes, there is a very substantial gap in our national finances. And not just us. Germany has announced that they are controlling their borrowing. Italy has done the same. The United States is raising taxes by $800 billion to bring down inflation.
Okay, so that was Jeremy Hunt just reacting after this morning's GDP figures that we broke for you live on Bloomberg Radio about 7 a.m. this morning. So look, this idea now of, austerity, what can Sunak do to preserve growth? And I like this line, and I'll say that it was stolen from one of my producers who put this question: is Sunak actually the new anti-growth coalition? I like that phrase.
Of course, that was Truss's famous phrase for all the people who stood against her. That didn't work out very well. He will definitely not consider himself part of the anti-growth coalition, but he is, the fiscal event coming up, and we're basically now contracting as an economy. We're expected to be now fully in a recession in the coming months and quarters. But he is going to have to squeeze the public finances because of the fiscal credibility gap that was left after the Truss and Kwarteng fiasco. So he's got his objective right now on November the 17th is to double down on delivering investor trust in the UK, and then come March when there's a budget. He was bound in November to say, you know, that there's going to be some sort of growth plans, there'll be supply side reforms, etc., but there won't be much money for growth. And then come March, if there's a little bit of tailwind, or if he's demonstrated that, you know, that fiscal credibility is so great that the borrowing costs of the UK come down, which give him a little bit of extra headroom, you'll start seeing money, I think, being pushed into sort of into delivering a growth agenda, because he's basically got 2 years to deliver something which the country can believe in, and you can't just believe in cuts.
Yeah, for clues on what that would be, I was looking back at the Mays lecture from February, and that was really Sunak setting out his economic vision. He said that he wanted business investment, R&D, boosting skills, a culture of enterprise. I wonder whether that's enough economically, if it's sexy enough politically, and really in this fiscal statement, is it really Sunakonomics more than Huntonomics that we're going to see?
Well, in this fiscal statement, I think we're just going to see sort of marketonomics, as in, you know, we've got to keep the markets happy. But his agenda is, someone described it as California on Thames, which I quite like. He's got his Silicon Valley experiences, and this idea of the entrepreneurialism, the capital. You know, he wants investment in capital, investment in ideas, investment in innovation. You know, this is.
Does it translate to investors? Have a listen to another little clip from Miles Selleck from the City UK, because this sort of gives you a flavour of like the business reaction, global investors, and whether they see the UK as less stable. Have a listen.
Reflecting the conversations that we've had with international counterparts and other potential investors in the UK, what people are looking for is stability. They're looking for predictability. I think the UK has been seen from a political perspective as just a little bit too exciting, certainly since 2016 and the Brexit vote and the sort of consequences that have flowed from that.
Okay, so we're too exciting. All right then. In that case, what do we make of Kwasi Kwarteng and the sort of apology, not apologising actually for the Liz Truss mini-budget, but for how it was done, you know, again, repeating this idea that it went too quickly. Phil, what do you make of that?
Well, it's he's trying to rationalise and pass the buck a bit. He stood there, delivered this fiscal package, and now he's saying it was kind of Truss pushed him into it. It's a pretty weak defence. But to a degree... If there had been a much cleverer sequencing, and perhaps the less sort of aggressively, you know, almost deliberately irritating tax cuts, like the additional rate 45p being completely scrapped in the middle of a bloody cost of living crisis, definitely wasn't particularly smart. But I think he's if he'd done the energy package, held off until later. And then they published the OBR's forecast, and they'd actually tried to balance the books and said, you know, these are our growth plans, but we're going to have to, you know, everything will be contingent. Our growth plans for tax rises, tax cuts will be contingent on our growth coming through. Then there's ways in which it could have worked.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.
Aside from austerity, there's another looming economic threat. Of course, the cost of living. With economic growth on the rocks, Rishi Sunak's not only facing really an impossible balancing act, the Bank of England too. They have to fight the wave of prices going up while knowing that higher interest rates are going to be very tricky for people and businesses across the UK. Now, our next guest, Deanne Julius, was a founding member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee back in the 1990s. So it was really interesting to catch up with her on Bloomberg Radio, and we spoke to her about where she sees and how high she sees interest rates going here in the UK.
I think I would see inflation or see interest rates, short-term rates, peak somewhere between 5% and 6%, frankly. Now, the Bank of England is saying they don't think they'll have to go that high, but it does depend very much on whether inflation is getting embedded into the economy beyond just the food and energy prices. So I think we really had a mixed message from the bank, from their inflation forecasts, which indeed showed inflation as still increasing, that it hadn't reached its peak yet. But then in the press conference afterwards, there was a surprising amount of focus on the alternative projection, which somewhat unbelievably showed that the forecast, if there were no further increase in rates, that is, if the bank rate stayed at 3%, over a 2-year, slightly longer period, inflation would sort of magically return back to target. Mm. And I think that's probably not something that many of us would rely upon.
Okay, that's interesting. So why do you think there is this disconnect between what the Bank of England presented there with this possibility of not, I mean, the suggestion seems to be from the inclusion of that data that maybe not many more rate hikes will be needed to bring inflation back to target. Why is there that disconnect between what the Bank of England is pushing for there and the way the BOE is pushing down on rate expectations and what you're talking about, which does seem to fit with market pricing a little bit more and expectation of many more hikes to come? Why is there that disconnect?
Well, it's purely my speculation. I suspect they were trying to nudge the markets over the yield curve down a bit in order to protect mortgage lending here. You know, we don't have 30-year mortgages like you do in the United States. And so it was quite a shock to a lot of people when interest rates went up even to 3%. And then, of course, the mortgages are not priced on short-term rates, but on medium-term rates. And those are hitting, you know, 5 and 6% for the mortgage by the time you add the credit spread. So that, I know that U.S. rates for mortgages are even higher, but the perspective of households here is that if their mortgage rate goes from where it's been, sort of 2%, up to something like 5 or 6%, that is a very significant hit to household budgets and therefore to consumption. So I think maybe the Bank of England was trying to give a message to the markets not to overreact to what's happening to interest rates at the short end and inflation right now.
I'm interested in just following up on this idea of rates peaking at 5 to 6%. If we're looking at rates at 3% now and mortgage rates for people at around 6%, how high do mortgage rates go if they peak at the level that you're talking about?
Well, I don't think mortgage rates themselves would go beyond 7, maybe 8%, although that would be pretty extreme. Extreme for anybody, you know, younger than about 40. Some of us have faced mortgage interest rates of 15%. That was quite a few years ago and quite a different situation. So I think it is a risk certainly for the housing market. We're seeing the beginnings of falls in house prices. They had been extremely high, so a fall is not necessarily a bad thing, but it does mean it puts a squeeze on household balance sheets, which themselves are pretty strong, but you know, they too could start to look weak.
So that was Deanne Julius, a founding member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. She's now fellow at Chatham House. So she was talking through where she sees interest rates going here in the UK. Well, of course, one of the issues that has made life so much more difficult for Andrew Bailey and co is what we discuss next. To round off this week, we're going to go back to where it all started. This, of course, is with Liz Truss's premiership in September. Very brief. Now, journalist James Heal has a book out, not just any book, one of the rare books, biographies, that was actually brought up at PMQs before it was even published by Keir Starmer. This is, of course, Out of the Blue, the inside story of the unexpected rise and rapid fall of Liz Truss, the biography of the former Prime Minister that spawned so many memes and is on bookshelves now. Bloomberg's Ewan Potts and I caught up with the author James Heal, who wrote this book along with the reporter Harry Cole from The Sun, looking back at Liz Truss's career.
Well, Liz Truss is quite a colourful, iconoclastic politician, so there was a lot of good things to write about it. But I suppose a couple of really good chapters stood out to me, one of which was the Turner-Taliban affair, which is when details of her extramarital affair came out and she had this battle with some of the more old-fashioned elements, shall we say, of her local party in 2009 for her candidate selection when she was going for an MP. That was one of them. I think also the trade years, when she really made her name at the Department for International Trade, doing those post-Brexit deals and sort of gallivanting across the Western world and signing those deals with different countries and what they got up to. I think that one was a particular favourite as well. And I'd also just say, finally, her time at the Treasury when she was the most junior member of the Cabinet, when she looked like she would get dismissed from political life between 2017 and 2019. And the way she sort of came back from that, reinvented herself, clawed herself back from the edge. So I'd say all those three chapters are really what stood out.
Okay. You're having to dig into the past, obviously, given that her tenure as Prime Minister was 50 days. I suppose it must have been rather traumatic to try to write a biography about such a short-lived PM.
Well, we were doing it the whole rise of her, really. So we thought we'd get 2 years out of this trust being in office, like most of the MPs and the public. So what was actually required was just a very hasty ending. But in terms of actually changing the book throughout, there wasn't that much. I mean, the clues were always there about what kind of Prime Minister she might be and how it could all go spectacularly wrong. So although I think, like a lot of people, Liz Truss gave us a fair few sleepless nights, it wasn't actually that so much for sort of rewriting the whole thing as just finishing off the ending and explaining how it all went so disastrously wrong.
James, tell us about the media storm. You write, it's quite amusing reading your Spectator piece about the media storm, which took place as you were just trying to get this book done. I mean, most authors would absolutely be thrilled to be caught up in this kind of thing, but it was different for you, wasn't it?
Oh, well, it was fairly surreal, I have to say. I mean, I think I first was aware that we'd become a bit of a meme online when both my father and my sister, who's at university, but just sent copies of, you know, this photo that was doing the rounds, of a photo of our book with 99p discount stickers on it saying, please take it, and the caption, if you're having a bad day at work, at least you know what James Heal has got a book out on Liz Truss in 6 weeks' time. And so that was all, it was quite meta and self-referential to see this go pretty viral on the internet. And then, of course, at Prime Minister's Questions, a week before Liz Truss went, the leader of the opposition, Sir Keir Starmer, mentioned it. And then all the media, of course, had to reference this upcoming book because he said, you know, the book is out in time for Christmas. Is that the release date or is that the title? And obviously out in time for Christmas. So that got a bit viral on TikTok as well. So all fairly, we couldn't plan for any of this, but we hopefully made the best of a unusual situation, shall we say.
What do you think that the Conservative Party has learnt from this disastrous episode? I mean, there seems to be now a kind of, we are still in this moment, a briefing wars of leaks, of vendettas. We've just seen it with Gavin Williamson. You've got a party that's been in government for 12 years. There's so much history. Can Sunak survive? Surely the Conservatives will be wiped out at the next election. What did they learn from the Liz Truss few weeks in office?
Yeah, the interregnum. I think that every election of a new leader is in some ways a reaction to the previous one. So the members and a lot of MPs wanted Liz Truss because they thought Boris Johnson was someone who couldn't keep his word. He was more interested in communication than policy, and they wanted a sounder line on certain issues. After the spectacular implosion of the Liz Truss premiership, now they return to Rishi Sunak, the man who was offering a detailed alternative to her throughout that whole summer. And having previously rebelled against Treasury orthodoxy and said, you know, we're going to go and have a very unorthodox plan. Now, instead, they're very much sticking with what the Treasury recommends. So I think that the danger is that there's always a sort of pendulum effect to sort of veer too far from the previous prime minister, the predecessor, there is a danger that perhaps you there's a case of wishful thinking. I think also it's testament to the factionalism in some ways, actually, because of the spectacular end of Liz Truss's premiership, it's made it easier for Rishi Sunak and his supporters to feel vindicated and say, look, guys, you tried the alternative and it didn't work, and we need to stick together on this one. I think, honestly, in a nutshell, it comes down to what one of Liz Truss's own advisors told me, which was someone in Number 10 who said it was hubris followed by nemesis. The dangers of speaking to a membership and forgetting about not just the country but the markets as well. And I think that mini budget was much more about a political reaction in Westminster and perhaps to an extent business rather than what the markets were thinking. And I think the markets just freaked out as a result of that.
So that was James Heal talking to us about Out of the Blue, the inside story of the unexpected rise and rapid fall of Liz Truss, the biography of the short-lived Prime Minister. Let's also look at what is ahead for us in the rest of the week, next week. So we've got Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, and we've had a long discussion about what we're expecting too from Budget Day, which is on Thursday. We're going to bring that to you live on Bloomberg Radio, Rishi Sunak and Jeremy Hunt's budget. But before that, on Monday, the G20 in Indonesia, President Joe Biden is going to be meeting Xi Jinping for the first face-to-face talks as president since the pandemic, of course. And also COP27 is ongoing next week.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.